This is Professor Chris Lewis. We're back with our lectures in managerial economics for the Economics 4010 class, Utah State University. And today we're going to be talking about Chapter 17, which is entitled Risk Analysis. And this is a bit of a change of pace from our previous chapters, and it actually involves using some statistical concepts. That the basic ones you learned in Stat 2300, but we'll go beyond that a little bit and show how these concepts are applied in an economics setting. We will also be making use of the overhead transparencies, but they're not quite as useful in this chapter, and we'll actually need to be referring to our textbook by Mark Hershey. And but let me begin by talking just a little bit about risk and uncertainty. If you invested $10,000 at your local bank in a 3-month certificate of deposit, the interest rate today on that might be 3%, but there would be effectively zero risk. That is, the bank is very unlikely to go out of business and be unable to return your interest and principal at the end of the 3 months. And even if the bank did fail, most banks are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC. And that insurance is there. In the event of a bank failure, they'll come in and make sure that the depositors are paid their value of their accounts, including interest, at least up to about $100,000. And there's a good principle there. Don't invest money in banks that don't have that kind of insurance. But there are lots of other investments. In fact, most investments that you will see in the business area involve substantial risk, meaning that there are a number of possible outcomes, some of which are very good and some of which may be very bad. For example, you may choose to invest your money in common stock. There have been years where the average returns on a typical common stock portfolio have been almost 50%. Now, that'd be great. At that rate, you'd double your money in less than 2 years. But there have been other years when prices have gone down, and sometimes significantly. I think the lowest single-year decline has been something on the order of 40%. And we saw, beginning in the spring of 2000, we saw common stock prices decline on average about 47% between the spring of 2000 and fall of 2001, a period of about 18 months. And the high-tech stocks, which are reflected in the NASDAQ stock average, fell about 80%. So when you invest in the stock market, people talk about there is substantial risk, and that is because there's substantial variability in the outcomes. Now, with regard to that, we need to talk briefly about the notion of a probability distribution. And a probability distribution is simply a listing of outcomes and the probability of those outcomes. For example, at the bottom of page 569, you'll see a listing of probabilities and profit outcomes for two projects, Project A and Project B. And you will note over to the left, they've got a listing of the state of the economy. That is, the profit outcome depends on whether we're having a normal year or a recession or a boom. And what we want to do is compute several statistics associated with the probability distribution. The first is the expected value, or in this example, the expected profit. And we find expected profit by multiplying the profit of each state of the economy times the profit outcome for that state, and then we add those products, that is the product of probability and outcome, we add those together. And you'll notice at the bottom of page 571 in the right hand column that shows probability times outcome. For example, 0.2 times 4,000 is 800. And there are three of those, 800, 3,000, 1,200. They're added up, and that gives us an expected profit for Project A. Now, for Project B, the outcomes, we have the same economy with the same probability of having a recession or a normal business year. But for Project A, we have different profit outcomes. For Project B, we have different profit outcomes. For example, the possible outcomes for Investment A are 4,000, 5,000, and 6,000. The possible outcomes for Project B are 0, 5,000, and 12,000. And if you look at the two pages over on page 572 at the bottom, the top of 573, it graphs the range of these profit outcomes. And we see that for Project B, there's a much wider range of outcomes. And we would say that Project B carries greater risk than Project A. But let's go back for just a second to the expected profit or expected value. For Project A, it's $5,000. For Project B, it's $5,400. Now, if you just looked at that result, you might say, well, it appears Project B is better. It has a greater expected profit. But invariably, if there's greater expected profit, there's greater risk. And we'll want to measure that risk here shortly. But the choice of two projects like A and B, A has a lower return but less risk. B has a higher expected return and greater risk. Some people would choose A and some people would choose B. This has to do with your preference for risk, and we'll get into that later in the chapter. Some people buy 3-month treasury bills. Some people buy short-term CDs at the bank. Other people invest in the stock market. Other people drill oil wells in unproven areas, so-called wildcat wells. We would expect risks to vary substantially among possible investments, and therefore we would undoubtedly find that the expected returns on these investments would be greater where there is greater risk. No one is going to invest their money in a wildcat oil well if the expected return was something, say 3% that you could get at a bank by taking no risk. The expected return on a wildcat oil well might have to be 40, 50, 60% in order to attract investors to that kind of activity. So what we need is a measure of risk, a quantitative measure that can be reduced to a number. And what we use in these cases is the standard deviation. And that gives us a quantitative measure of the amount of risk. And again, if you'll refer to the bottom of page 573, there's a formula for the variance, and then if we take the square root of that, and that's shown at the top of 574, this is the formula for the standard deviation of a probability distribution. And that formula for sigma indicates that what we do is we take each outcome in a probability distribution. We subtract the expected outcome and square that difference. And then we multiply that difference by the probability. For example, in the first row of the table at the top of 574, you'll notice that the first expected outcome is 4,000. We subtract the expected outcome of 5,000, yielding a difference of minus 1,000. Then we square that difference. That gives us 1,000,000, as shown in the middle of the table. And then we multiply by the probability 0.2, and we get a value of 200,000. We repeat this for all three outcomes, and then we add those three numbers together. That technically gives us the variance, which is sigma squared, and then we have to take the square root of that, and we get a value of the standard deviation of $632. Now, that's for project A. Now, if you repeat that for project B, you will get a standard deviation of 3,826. This is not shown, the computation of that's not shown with a table, but it's just reported there below the table at the top of page 574. So our estimate of risk for project A is $632. The estimate of risk for project B is 3,826. And so now we've quantitatively measured the expected return and the risk. And again, we can't say one project is better than another without knowing what the investor's preference for risk is. And again, we have to wait to do that at the end of the chapter. Finally, there is a measure of relative risk, and that is the coefficient of variation, which is defined by the ratio of sigma over the expected return. That is, you would divide sigma by the expected return. And this also tells us something that we might call risk per dollar of expected return. And if there are two projects that have significantly different expected returns, it may be a little hard to compare the value of sigma for both of these. And so we can reduce it to sort of a common denominator by computing risk per dollar of return, that is, dividing the risk for each project by its expected return. All right, if we go to slide number 12, there's a listing of called possible risk attitudes. And what we find is that there are people who don't like risk. And in fact, most people are found in that category. If you really observe their behavior, they tend to minimize risks, especially when it comes to investing money. At the other end of the spectrum, there are a group of people who are risk-seeking. These are the gamblers, those who go to Las Vegas and wager large sums of money on the spin of a wheel or the draw of a card, or those who are willing to take on risky investments like the Wildcat oil well we were just talking about. And in between might be those who are said to be risk neutral. They can take it or leave it. And the relationship between money and the utility associated with that money helps us to define this preference for risk. Now, at the bottom of slide 12, it talks about it's a risk aversion. It says risk aversion implies DMU for money. That means diminishing marginal utility of money. And the more money we have, the less utility we get from each additional dollar. Yes, we like that additional dollar and we want it, but it doesn't generate as much utility as did the previous dollar that we got. And this is true of most people. And in that case, we would say that people that have that kind of utility function will be risk averse for reasons that we'll see in a minute. And if you go to slide 13, this slide has a graph showing the marginal utility of money for those three types of people. Line A shows diminishing marginal utility. And this would be characteristic of a risk-averse person or a risk-averter. Line B, which shows a straight line or constant marginal utility of money, this reflects a person who is indifferent to risk, and that person is sometimes said to be risk neutral. And finally, function C, which shows increasing marginal utility of money, and we say a person like that would be a risk seeker or a risk seeking person. Now, we can apply these principles to our decisions. Think about buying a lottery ticket, which I think I've said before is a dumb idea. And it's a dumb idea because the probability of losing your dollar is about 0.99999. with a whole bunch more nines, and the probability of winning that big lottery prize, the $20 million or $50 million, is something like 0.0000, about 16 zeros and a one. And if you were to compute the expected outcome, if you were to multiply the possible returns, and those returns, let's say, are zero and $20 million, and multiply each of those outcomes by the probability and add them up, you would see that the expected value or the expected outcome is 50 cents. So you're buying a lottery ticket for a dollar expecting a return of 50 cents. Now, just on its face, and if the only thing that was important were the dollars, you wouldn't do this. If you were risk neutral or risk averse, you certainly wouldn't buy those lottery tickets. But there's a whole lot of people who do. I guess there are millions of them, because there's certainly more money wagered. There's twice as much money wagered as there is money won. What is the explanation for this? And the explanation lies in those curves we saw in slide 13. That is, if you're a risk seeker and each additional dollar of money generates more utility than did the previous dollar, then you can show that the purchase of a lottery ticket, that uncertain outcome of winning zero or $20 million, generates enough utility that there will be an increase in utility associated with buying that lottery ticket. I think it's irrational for most people, and I think the government ought not to be in the business, but that's not important for us right now. We want to cover the economics of this. Now, we're about at our time limit, so we'll close part A and go on to part B.